Bob, and I'm here with Russell Clark, who is the author of many books, but today we are interviewing him on Memoirs of a Blind Biker, Do You See What I See? This is Russell's autobiography after a long and distinguished career in breaking through things that are not always what they seem to be. Hello, Russell, how are you?
Good morning, I'm very happy to be with you today.
I guess it is morning in California, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, well, thanks for getting up early. Russell, we've interviewed you several times on Temple of Health and have always been fascinated by your story, and so I'm very pleased that you put this together in an autobiography. It is an actual amazing tale of not just your history, but the history of psychic research in general.
Well, it shows that if you live long enough, you get to do a lot of interesting things.
That's right. Well, you were born in Chicago, raised in New York City, and you were originally a physicist, is that right?
Yes, I like to think that I am still a physicist.
And you want to tell our audience a little bit about your early training and how you got into, the science of your scientific background first, and then how you got into psychic
research.
Well, as
a physicist, I was involved in the development of the laser. So in the 1950s, I worked with Gordon Gould, who's credited with inventing the laser, and I worked with him for many years, and we made one of the very first lasers. And I pursued laser research for about 15 years until I decided to pursue my passion, which was research into extrasensory perception. But I got interested in ESP as a child growing up in New York, where I could visit the magic shows on 42nd Street, where you had a whole cave underneath the penny arcades, where you had magicians, hermaphrodites, strongmen, all shooting galleries, all kinds of different things. But I used to hang out with the magician doing tricks right in front of me,
mm-hmm.
and then I could go upstairs to the magic store, talk to magicians, buy books, and buy tricks. And all through school and graduate school, I was a magician in New York. And my experience was that from time to time, while fooling the adults in the audience with mind-reading acts, mental mm-hmm. magic, I would occasionally get a impression that went beyond the trick I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretending to read somebody's mind, but I would actually get a picture of what their house looked like, and go upstairs, and I could see the patchwork quilt on their bed, and
mm-hmm.
supplement my trickery with some genuine ESP. And eventually, I decided as a young scientist that it was more interesting to try and understand how that psychic stuff worked, rather than just going on to fool adults.
Right. Well, that's great.
So I became familiar with the pioneers in parapsychology in America. I met J.B. Rhine
mm-hmm.
at Duke University and a number of other people. And eventually, by 1972, I co-founded a ESP research program at Stanford Research Institute. And that's what moved me from the straight-up physics track to doing research in parapsychology. And we're basically psychic spies for the government during the whole Cold War period. So I moved from doing stage magic to doing research in ESP that was quite operational, working for the CIA and other government agencies. So it was applied ESP.
So I think somebody said this, I'm not sure who, but somebody said, that, it might have been Einstein, that anybody who has sufficiently advanced science appears as magic to people who don't have sufficiently.
Yeah, I think Arthur C. Clarke said that.
Oh, okay, great. Right.
Any sufficiently advanced technology will appear as magic.
Well,
for example, if I came to Einstein
mm-hmm.
with my iPhone, a little
right.
little block, you take it apart, there's nothing in it to see, but I can go to the internet and call my friends all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be no way for a mid-20th century person to understand that. It would just be utterly incomprehensible. that Einstein would have to assume that it was from another planet.
That's
or another civilization, because this was before the transistor.
Yes.
So somebody who didn't know about transistors saw this thing, it simply would make no sense at all. He couldn't get a purchase on it.
That's
and ESP is a little like that right now.
Right. But it won't be. I mean, it will be eventually, with the new theories that we have, Laszlo's science and the Akashic Field and other theories of consciousness, it actually is not at all outside the realm of spiritual science.
Well, what brings ESP within modern science is the idea of non-locality.
Right.
The idea that things that appear separated from one another are really connected.
Mm-hmm.
And this has a lot of currency in modern physics. So if I was back at Columbia in graduate school, I would probably be doing research in non-locality, exploring how elementary particles that are born together travel away from one another at the speed of light are still connected.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of non-local connection is the most interesting and productive area of research in modern physics. And it's the idea that you and I are 3,000 miles away, but I can have a thought or look at an object on my desk, and in the quiet of the evening, you could describe what the object was that I have on my desk,
mm-hmm.
even though we're quite far apart and I'm not going to tell you. So the kind of mind-to-mind connection goes along with the idea of non-locality. And Schrodinger, the great Viennese physicist, discovered entanglement and non-locality in the 1920s. In the 1930s, Einstein said that that's impossible because it appears to violate relativity,
mm-hmm.
and he was mistaken.
Right.
And then in the 1970s, non-local connections were demonstrated to be true in the physics lab at the University of California, Berkeley. And then in the 1990s, it was demonstrated over long distances, many kilometers,
mm-hmm.
by Nicholas Jeyson in Geneva, and no one doubts non-locality anymore. But of course, the idea of non-local connections was understood in the Vedic teachings that Atman equal Brahman 4,000 years ago. The idea that your Atman, your awareness, is one with Brahman, which is all of physical and non-physical space.
Mm-hmm.
That a yogi sitting quietly on a rock 4,000 years ago noticed that his awareness filled all of space-time. And in the Hindu Vedas, that was taught and continues to be taught. Every page of the Buddha's teaching, the Prajnaparamita, you find that separation is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, well, Schrodinger, my hero, said really clearly consciousness is a singular of which there is no plural. There's one consciousness, many bodies.
Right.
And that's what appears to be going on.
Well, and it's amazing too that the direct knowledge through meditation and through expanding awareness actually brought in information that couldn't be scientifically proved until, hundreds and thousands of years later.
Well, the idea of how to prove something scientifically wasn't really understood.
That's right.
But my fun,
or even why we needed to.
That's right. My fun these days is to go around the world teaching people how to do remote viewing. Remote viewing is the ability we all have to quiet your mind and describe and experience what's happening in a distant place or even in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really teach remote viewing. I give people permission to make use of an ability they already have.
Right.
People are born psychic, but in America in particular, it's repressed or forbidden. People are afraid that you'll laugh at them if they tell you about an ESP experience. But in other places like Iceland or Holland or Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
Psychic abilities are quite, or Brazil particularly,
mm-hmm.
psychic abilities are quite ordinary.
Yeah, well, they're not suppressed. I think when you're a child and when you demonstrate these abilities and people tell you that that can't be or otherwise suppress you, then you naturally, you know, go away from that because it's not being rewarded or recognized.
My daughter Elizabeth was a psychiatrist who did pioneering work in distant healing and the effects of prayer to heal her AIDS patients. But as a child, I expected her to be polite and intelligent and psychic. Like, that is when if she had a birthday, I expected her to be able to describe what was in the present before she opened it.
There you go.
So Elizabeth had exceptional amount of permission and encouragement to develop her psychic abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And as she grew up and became a psychiatrist, her work, what she's best known for, is a study in which she had people all over the country pray for half of her AIDS patients in a double-blind study.
Mm-hmm.
She had 60 AIDS patients and healers across America, energy healers, spiritual prayer people, Barbara Brennan, aura people, Reiki healers, all kinds of people who were very experienced, people who had been healing for a decade.
Right.
And the 30 people in Elizabeth's experiment for whom prayers were said had much better outcomes than the controls.
Mm-hmm.
The people who for whom prayers were said had fewer opportunistic illnesses, fewer trips to the hospital, had better psychiatric self-report, that is, they felt better.
Right.
So it was a very important study. It was published in the Western Medical Journal and has encouraged the National Institutes of Health to support other studies demonstrating the efficacy of prayer or distant mental influence. And I'm sure that Elizabeth moved her psychiatric profession in the direction of distant healing because she had a lot of encouragement to be psychic and investigate psychic stuff as a child.
And this would be sort of the application in medicine for non-locality.
Absolutely.
I think that's her experiment is probably the premier experiment that demonstrated the principle of non-locality as applied to medicine.
Yeah, Daniel Benor has a big book on spiritual healing,
mm-hmm.
where he has a couple of hundred very well-documented experiments and cases where people were healed in formal experiments as a result of somebody sending them healing regards.
Right.
And this distant
mm-hmm.
healing is independent of space.
Mm-hmm.
That is, a Reiki healer, as you know, will send me healing energy from across the country as well as across the room.
Mm-hmm.
So the evidence for this kind of healing being non-local is very good.
And the opposite of that, as pointed out by Dr. Larry Dawsey, is medical hexing. When doctors tell people that they're not going to do well. And that's the kind of the opposite, sending the negative thoughts. And think about it. When your doctor keeps thinking you're not going to do well, what does that do non-locally? No,
that's right. My son is an anesthesiologist, and he told me that they're instructed never to say negative things about the patient while they're under anesthesia.
That's a good idea.
So they're often able to hear what mm-hmm. you say. So
yeah,
somebody's still in anesthesia and he hears you say, "This guy's a goner."
Yeah,
it's very bad for their prognosis.
For the worse. That's true. And we actually use headphones during some surgeries just so they won't hear the chatter back and forth between the surgical team, especially when we get into situations that are less than.
That's very interesting.
The bleeding and these things happen and you have to communicate. I mean, you know, like you have to tell anesthesia if you're starting to lose blood, you know. But if we put headphones on people. But I believe, a lot of my patients are very spiritually evolved and I believe that they also at a higher level are looking in and seeing what's going on. So I don't think the headphones completely stop the flow of information to them, as we are all truly connected.
This remote viewing used to be exotic. When we started our program in 1972,
mm-hmm.
we were working with the Central Intelligence Agency and Defense Intelligence Agency during the Cold War. Now, of course, the CIA is not my favorite person to work for, but my partner Hal Puthoff and I felt that we had uncovered an ability that might prevent the Cold War from being a hot war.
Right.
So as scientists, we're basically in favor of intelligence instead of ignorance.
Right.
I know not everybody agrees with that, but during the period of our activity, during our 20-year program, we were able to give useful information to the government. We were able to describe a Soviet weapons factory where no one knew what they were building inside of a sealed-up brick building.
Mm-hmm.
Psychic policeman that we worked with, Pat Price, was able to quiet his mind and describe that the Russians were constructing a large steel sphere.
Mm-hmm.
They're welding it together out of gore, out of orange, sort of slices, and he could describe that very accurately. And it was confirmed 2 years later by satellite photography. And what they were building was a particle beam weapon to shoot down our satellites that were taking the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the only ones in America who had that information about this Soviet weapon system. And the fact that we were able to do that was one of our big successes and helped support our program for the next decade.
That was what was it called?
Stargate program.
Stargate program, right.
Those photos had been secret, and now I publish those in my book, Do You See What I See?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm able to, about a decade ago, I got the program declassified,
mm-hmm.
so I can now publish pictures from the Stargate program,
right.
which I do in my memoir. But one of the more interesting things that we did in that program, the CIA came to us and said, we want to know what's happening at these geographical coordinates 3 days from now.
Mm-hmm.
We know you can describe things in the distance, and we'd like you to describe this distant place in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And Ingo Swann, who was really the father of remote viewing,
mm-hmm.
New York artist, he's still a New York artist. He called for his colored pencils and said, this is a beautiful pyrotechnic display. I understand what you want me to describe. Looks like the 4th of July. And he drew the colored display with a bunch of trucks in the background. And the CIA took one look at that. And what they realized is that this was going to be a Chinese atomic bomb test, which they had suspected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to fail, because what Swan had drawn is what you get when you burn uranium in the air and it fails to explode. It burns in this kind of pyrotechnic 4th of July fashion. And indeed, we did the experiment on Monday, and 4 days later on Thursday, the Chinese did their atomic bomb test, and indeed it failed. So it shows that it shows how the future affects the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's what a physicist would call retrocausality. And as you know, many people have their first contact with psychic phenomena, with ESP of any kind, in a precognitive dream,
mm-hmm.
where people, in the course of their sleep, will have a dream of some bizarre thing, and then it comes to pass the next day. So, for example, if you have a dream tonight, Saturday night, you dream an elephant is walking down your street and tramples your garden.
Mm-hmm.
You wake up in the morning and tell your friend, I had this really crazy dream about an elephant in the garden. And he says, well, if you look out the window, I think that's an elephant there right now. So we would say that Sunday morning's elephant was the cause of your Saturday night dream. So
right.
something that happened to you Sunday caused you to have an experience at an earlier time.
And that is actually explained, well, I guess there are two ways to look at that. It's explained by understanding multidimensional reality, whereas we are also in a segment of reality that where time-space is not a construct. Is that correct?
Well, it's multidimensional in the sense that, well, modern physics agrees that something like this can happen because non-local reality, the idea of non-locality, says that our understanding of space-time is incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
So I just co-sponsored a conference on retrocausality at the University of California in San Diego, where we had mainly physicists plus a few ESP researchers investigating the phenomena in physics that appear where the cause occurred before the effect.
Mm-hmm.
But the most common example we have of that is a precognitive dream, where
right.
your mind is quiet and you are open to the exciting events of the next day. But what you said is true, that as we live in a multidimensional space-time, you and I walk along exposing the future at the rate of 1 second per second
mm-hmm.
as we creep along the timeline. But there is really a complex space-time, additional spatial and temporal dimensions, not available to our body, but available to our awareness, so that in a model of non-locality, there is always a way to connect you sitting at where you are right now, at this space and this time.
Mm-hmm.
You can connect your awareness to any other point in space-time with a path of zero distance, even though there may be thousands of miles and many hours separating you from the distant point. You can connect to that nonetheless.
And throughout my life, I've actually had it connect to me. As far back as I can remember, I've had visions. And the visions are very quick. They block out this reality, and they're very accurate. What I see usually happens. And so when I went to do remote viewing experiments at the university I was at, it wasn't hard for me to connect. I think maybe myself and some other people who are able to do this easily and without much effort just naturally have those connections.
I think that the most interesting thing about remote viewing, if I was going to say one most interesting thing, is how easy it is to do.
Right.
That
you
I
just have
be,
to not believe you can't do it.
That I can just be doing something simple like a book signing.
Right.
And at the end, if I have a nice group, I'll say, well, I have an interesting object in my bag here.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to pull out your notebooks and just make a drawing of what I have?
Right.
And people are able to do that surprisingly well.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
and they're often shocked at how well they do, and then they buy my book. But the
That's
idea is that they say, what does it cost to learn how to remote viewing? Is it a weekend workshop? Do I have to go away for a week?
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, you just have to give me your attention for 5 minutes.
Right.
And if you will sit down and be quiet,
mm-hmm.
then I will show you what to do.
Right.
So it's an ability we have. You don't have to go to school to learn to be psychic. Somebody just has to tell you that it's all right. And it's like meditation. You have to find a way to stop the chatter.
Right, exactly.
So if I'm lecturing in a metaphysical bookstore, that usually works better than a department store.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the energy is a little bit higher in the metaphysical bookstore and is more conducive to that sort of mindset. So.
But one of the best evidences for our non-local ability was in the 1980s, after I left the Stanford research program, I had the idea that what people really understand is money. So
mm-hmm.
if we could forecast the stock market, that would get us some attention. Mm-hmm. So working with an experienced psychic and an enthusiastic investor, we decided to forecast changes in the silver commodity market.
Mm-hmm.
So each week for 9 weeks, I would interview the psychic on Monday morning and say, here we are. On Friday, I'm going to put an interesting object in your hand. I don't know what it could be, but I'm going to give you something interesting that the broker has chosen based on whether silver has gone up a little or up a lot or down a little or down a lot. So down in Montgomery Street in the financial district, somebody has lined up 4 objects on his desk and assigned them market conditions. So if the market goes up a lot, I will show you the up a lot object, but don't worry about that now. Just tell me what I'm going to hand you.
Right.
So we did that every Monday morning for 9 weeks, and we were correct every day, every
mm-hmm.
time. So we made 9 forecasts, and all 9 forecasts were correct, and we made $120,000
mm-hmm.
purely psychically.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we would buy or sell silver depending on whether the psychic saw a tuna fish sandwich or a light bulb.
Right.
So this is really putting your money where your ESP is.
Yeah, that's true.
So we were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal,
uh-huh.
and Nova made a film about us.
That's great.
And I repeated that working with a spiritual healer, Jane Catra,
mm-hmm.
in the 1990s. I wrote a book called Miracles of Mind,
mm-hmm.
and the publisher said, well, if you're able to do psychic stuff, you should do it. The author should do it if you're going to teach us how to do remote viewing. And we were, again, very successful in our forecast. We were correct 11 out of 12 times. They'll show that even a scientist can be psychic if the
mm-hmm.
necessity level is high enough.
Yeah, well, that's true.
So now there is a organization called the International Remote Viewing Association, IRVA.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, your listeners might be interested in the it's called IRVA.org. And this is a organization interested in research in remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started, International Remote Viewing Association. It was started, I was part of the origin of that, but it's really run by the people who were doing remote viewing for the Army during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
We, Hal Putoff and I and Ingo Swan, ran this program at Stanford Research Institute in California. But a few years into the program, the government got tired of having to get their information only from psychics of California.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted us to train Army intelligence officers to do remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So we helped, we did, we trained, basically Ingo Swan trained Hal and me to do remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Hal and I trained 6 Army intelligence officers, and they set up a remote viewing organization at Fort Meade,
mm-hmm.
and then those 6 people trained the world.
Right.
So right now, in a certain sense, I know it seems that remote viewing is esoteric, cracking open the door of the occult, but if you go to Google,
mm-hmm.
there's more than 1 million pages devoted to remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not secret anymore.
No.
And, of course, not only is it not secret, it's never been secret.
Right. That's true. Well, I mean, I interviewed Joseph McMonagle on, I think, 3 or 4 occasions. And, I mean, he basically worked for every organization that had 3 letters, you know.
That's right. And I had the privilege of showing Joe how to do remote viewing.
Right, right.
That doesn't make me a great psychic. I just had a man with a lot of talent. He was one of the 6 that Hal and I chose
mm-hmm.
from a big group of Army intelligence volunteers. We went to Fort Meade and interviewed a whole bunch
mm-hmm.
of people. And Joe is one who is obviously a standout.
Mm-hmm.
So we invited him to California. And he has been doing remote viewing for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an important idea. In the early work that J.B. Rhine did at Duke University, he was having people psychically describe his famous ESP cards.
Mm-hmm.
Circle, square, wavy line, stars, cross, so forth. And although some people were very good at the beginning, they usually got worse.
Mm-hmm.
The famous decline effect. And the decline effect in early parapsychology was due to two causes. One is that people were bored into a decline.
Mm-hmm.
Because after weeks of guessing circles, squares, and stars, you get tired of it.
You get bored.
And also, once you know what the target pool is, for example, if I tell you I have two objects on my desk, I have a knife and a pencil,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to pick up one, that would make it extremely hard for you to psychically describe what I picked up,
mm-hmm.
because you now have a perfect picture of the two objects.
Right, that's true.
Whereas if I said, my desk is cluttered with interesting objects from all over the world, and I've just chosen one, what do you see?
Right.
Even though in that case, there's infinitely many possibilities in a certain sense, because you have no, what the remote viewers call front loading. You have no analytical noise. I've told you that the object in my hand could be anything in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it easier than telling you that it's a knife or a pencil.
Right, it does.
So that's a kind of non-intuitive thing that we learned in the remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of my story is that a decade, or really 2 decades now, after Joe started remote viewing, he's getting better and better.
Yeah.
So in remote viewing, the big difference, the life-saving difference between remote viewing and ESP at Duke University is that the remote viewers get better and the card guessers get worse.
Mm-hmm.
There's no decline in remote viewing, and it's a very important idea.
Yeah. Well, I was in the government, in the military, in the U.S. Air Force for 13 years, and I can guarantee you that they're not going to spend time or effort on things that don't work. You know,
That's a good point.
But it's true. I mean, anybody who's been in the government knows that they're not going to do that. I mean, they're at least the military is results-oriented, and so you have to show them that it's going to work.
So I could tell you about all our psychic feats and the amazing things we did, but in a sense, based on what you just said, the best evidence we have for the reality of ESP is that we had a program that worked for that was continuously supported for 25 years by the government.
Mm-hmm.
That I went back to doing physics. After leaving SRI, I went back to my roots
mm-hmm.
with lasers and started. I had an idea that it was possible to use lasers to detect air turbulence and wind shear on airplanes. It's an
mm-hmm.
idea that I had had for many years. Lasers can detect fluctuations in the air in front of them, and I wound up putting lasers on airplanes so they wouldn't crash.
That's pretty important.
That was a useful thing to do.
Absolutely.
And it was much easier to get money from the CIA to do ESP than it is to get money from NASA to detect wind shear.
That is absolutely amazing.
So, but both of those.
I think CIA have a much bigger slush fund.
Probably
did. The secret, the stuff that they talk about on Charlie Wilson's War,
Interesting. Both programs were called remote sensing.
Really? Isn't that interesting?
And it's easier to do remote sensing with ESP than with lasers. Mm-hmm. Because the lasers don't work worth a damn when it's raining,
mm-hmm.
and the rain doesn't interfere with ESP at all.
Right, right.
But the point is, to get government funding supported and renewed year after year for 2 decades is a paranormal event all by itself.
Isn't it? Well, it just goes to show that it worked and it was useful, and they applied it because they wouldn't have kept paying for it if they couldn't apply it.
I think that's true. And the idea of we can inflow information, we can do psychic spying, we can forecast the future, and we can do intuitive diagnosis. You probably have experience with that.
I do.
And one of the things that I'm finding, I had a housemate who had gone to the Berkeley Psychic College,
mm-hmm.
and she encouraged me to investigate intuitive diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, being a physicist before I did that, I got the teaching company's 36 6-hour DVDs of anatomy and physiology so that if I would psychically see something, I could name what it was.
Right. You have to have the files.
Because otherwise you close your eyes and you just see meat.
Right.
You have no way of,
you don't know where it is.
You can't tell a pancreas from a gallbladder.
Right. That's true.
But I was quite surprised to find that intuitive diagnosis was easier for me to do than remote viewing. And in workshops, people find that easier to do than remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So that even after they've been doing remote viewing for a day, I then have people pair up and do the intuitive diagnosis. They all say, well, why didn't we start with this? This is so much easier to do.
Well, it may be that it's easier to read an energy system of a living thing. I mean, it doesn't have to be a human. It could be an animal. Than it is to read the energy system of something that's not living. Because really, remote viewing, that's what you're doing. You're reading the energy signature of something that does not have life force energy necessarily. I mean, it can. I mean, obviously, the remote viewers were able to see. They were able to see the people that had died in the airplane crashes, weren't they?
That's right.
That, you want to talk about that a little bit? Because that's very interesting.
Well, what I wanted to mention is that if people are interested, I'm teaching a workshop on the East Coast at the Omega Institute at the end of August.
Oh, great.
And it's a weekend workshop. Mm-hmm. And you can get information either calling Omega, which is in Rhinebeck, New York, or go to my website. My website has all sorts of interesting things on it. My website is www.espresearch.com. So the letters espresearch.com. And that shows you what I've been up to and gives people a way to communicate with me.
Great.
We did one of the things we were asked to do in our program was help find a downed Russian airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA knew that a Russian airplane full of code books, a reconnaissance plane, a Russian bomber, had crashed in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very exciting if we could find that before the Russians. So I worked with Joe McMonagle, and we had a map of Africa, and he would close his eyes. I'd see a river, and then he'd follow the river. I'm following the river north. There are mountains to the east. I see a village to the west. And between the river and the village is where the airplane crashed. And he put a circle on the map,
mm-hmm.
and the airplane was found within the circle.
My goodness.
And we beat the Russians and found the airplane. Mm-hmm. And it was a very celebrated event for us.
Right.
In fact, Jimmy Carter, at a commencement address at Emory College, told all about it in such detail that we had to change the name of our program, which had been secret. Somebody asked Carter.
That is so funny.
Somebody asked
Carter. Too much information, huh?
That's right. Because we beat the Russians. We were able to. CIA was able to send agents on the ground to actually get to the airplane. And we had no information except that it crashed in Africa because nobody knew where it was.
Right.
It's like finding downed airplanes or kidnap people
mm-hmm.
is the best kind of experiment you could do because there's no way to cheat.
Right. Either you find them or you don't.
Yes, and there's nobody who could have given you the information.
Right.
So that's one of the things that makes it very important. And I guess the two things that we know about remote viewing that is why we say it pertains to non-locality is that increasing the distance between the viewer and the target doesn't make it any harder. So remote viewing accuracy and reliability is independent of distance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's called a non-local. That's the essence of non-locality,
mm-hmm.
is that increasing the distance, it's no harder to see a person or heal a person across the country than it is across the room.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, it's no harder to see what's going to happen a few hours or days in the future than it is to see something contemporaneously. In fact, when we went to Russia in the 80s, we were working with a famous psychic Soviet healer, Juna Davidashvili. We did experiments with her where we asked her to describe where somebody would be in San Francisco, which was 6,000 miles to the west and 2 hours in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And what she would describe is where this fellow would be, but at the time she was describing it, he was asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So he would then get up, throw a die on the floor, and go to one of six possible places, which I didn't know about. And Juna, in her apartment in Russia, drew pictures and gave a description, which were very, very accurate, of where he went in the future. And this was all recorded by us and by the Soviet Academy of Sciences. In one case, Juna said, "I see something very strange. I see an animal with large glass animal eyes and pointy ears," and he had gone to a merry-go-round on a amusement pier in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and taken pictures of the, I guess it was a large horse that he was riding on, mm-hmm. with glass eyes and pointy ears. So he had a photograph exactly which he described. And the other thing she described was a large church. Now, this is Russia, so she said this is a very interesting building devoted to a famous man. It looks like they're having a party because I see lots of candles. people go in and out of this place, but then nobody lives there.
Mm-hmm.
This is some kind of celebration.
Hmm.
And she said everything except church.
Right.
So we thought that was interesting. But in both cases, she had to describe things before they were chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So in my view of this, it shows that the future affects mm-hmm. the past. That an event which has not yet occurred affects her behavior and her
right.
affects her thought processes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no harder to see the future than it is to see the distance. And it's the essence of a non-local phenomena.
So whatever arena we're dealing with in this skill is obviously not limited to the third dimension.
That's right. And this was all under, the Buddhists understood this in detail 1,200 years ago.
Right.
The great Buddhist teacher Padmasambhava, who his friends called Guru Rinpoche, is a historical person who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book a lot like my book, except 800 years earlier, called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And he described that suffering comes from being trapped in a life of the ego, trapped mm-hmm. by the story of who you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
And what your parents and church tells you, and he calls that all conditioned awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Your experience is conditioned by the newspapers and the current theory and the current teachings, and as a result, you never get to see things as they are because you're trapped in this story. You're basically trapped by your business card. You spend your life... If you spend your life defending what it says on your business card, you're in for a lot of suffering.
Yeah, because in the end, you don't exist as that entity anyway. I mean,
that's right.
It's 100% guaranteed, at this point in time anyway, that all of us will pass from our business card to the next world, you know, where we're not our business card.
Yeah, and Padmasambhava invited us to move from conditioned awareness to naked awareness or spaciousness.
Mm. Right.
So you're sitting in meditation, and you notice that your awareness fills all of space. You can move mm-hmm. from your conditioning and your contemporaneous worries into mm-hmm. spaciousness and naked awareness. And the Buddhists often talk about emptiness, that mm-hmm. the world is an illusion. And people often hate that because they're the Buddhists saying that there's nothing there. It looks to me like there's a coffee cup and a book right there. And the Buddhists are not saying that there's nothing there. What they're saying is that the things that you apprehend don't have the meaning that you think they have.
Mm-hmm.
That the things are empty of meaning, or that the universe is empty of meaning, it's not empty of things.
Right, and that's the first line in the Course of Miracles. You know, you look at everything in the room and say that, you know, that coffee cup has no meaning, that door has no meaning, and then unless I assign it a meaning.
That's a question.
And it's very freeing to know that you can assign meaning to everything in your world, and then therefore transform your world into something that's dangerous and fearful and hateful into something wondrous and miraculous and supportive, which is, you know, what we do with, you know, spiritual growth. We take the one and we transform it into the other.
Yeah, I agree with that. Of course, the Miracles have a lot of very profound things to teach. They have this particular idea as one of their teachings that everything I experience has only the meaning I give it.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that things occur, somebody can say something to you, and then you can either laugh at them or be heartbroken.
Right.
It's the idea that if somebody went to the Dalai Lama and said to him, why are you still wearing that silly outfit? Why don't you get some real clothes?
Mm-hmm.
And I would be shocked to see that. How could you be so disrespectful?
Mm-hmm.
The Dalai Lama wouldn't be shocked. He would laugh.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he laughs at most of what people say to them.
He sure does, doesn't he?
And the reason that he laughs...
And rightly so.
He doesn't laugh out of disrespect.
No, he laughs because it's funny.
Or it's out of compassion at
how limited their world is.
That's right. Exactly. How serious their misunderstanding of the world is.
Yeah.
People always come to ask him questions, and their question reveals profound misunderstanding of what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Buddha said, I am no different than you. I am simply awake, which is... I keep that in mind a lot, because when I have a tendency toward to have limited consciousness in a certain area, I try to say, now what would Buddha think of this? What, you know, how could I expand my awareness here so as not to go into suffering? And it works. It's interesting.
Yeah, and the Course
of Miracles.
It really does.
It's very freeing.
The Course of Miracles teaches that Jesus is just an older brother who became awakened before you.
Right. And I think, I think that right now, as we're undergoing a more accelerated form of this awakening, people are either spiraling up or spiraling down. And, it's going to be a very interesting few years as the gap between the two groups increases. So for some, this world is going to become more fearful, more dangerous, more... you know, everything negative, and for others, it's going to go in the opposite direction. And it's still the same world. You know, there's no difference. It's just how you're conscious of what's going on in your particular perceptual reality. And your perceptual reality is different than other people's perceptual reality. I think we have to respect that we're not all in the same movie, and have compassion about that.
Yeah. I mean, what gives meaning to our lives is to experience our divinity, our spaciousness,
mm-hmm.
and then to teach that.
Right.
So the Buddhas teach a lot of suffering in the world, and most of it is unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a concentration camp or you're starving, then I recognize that there's physical suffering.
Right.
But most suffering is defending our ego, defending
mm-hmm.
our story.
Right, it is. Or defending what you think is the status quo and causing suffering of others because you are going to keep your status quo intact no matter what. When in actuality, if you look at history, things keep moving on. We keep evolving spiritually, genetically, everything. There's evolution in all forms of life. In general, it is the nature of life to evolve. And if you want to hold on to the past and really, you know, hold on to 50s thinking, 60s thinking, or whatever, or 1800 thinking, you do suffer. you have to be fluid enough to move on into the future.
Yeah, I agree with that. In my memoir, I describe that. I describe a little sort of five keys to liberation from mindfulness, emptiness, compassion, community, and gratitude. And the idea of mindfulness is to be aware that we can experience transcendent knowing, which is the remote viewing we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
transcendent doing, which is the spiritual healing that my daughter pursued,
mm-hmm.
the ability that we can send our healing intentions to a distant person and reduce their suffering and speed up their cure, and transcendent being, which is residing in this spaciousness. Well, one of the things that Padmasambhava talked about 1,200 years ago is that in order to see things with naked awareness, you have to give up your desire to name them and grasp them.
Mm-hmm.
So he was aware, and he was able to articulate all those years ago, that the thing that if interferes with psychic ability or with seeing the world as it is our desire to name things. Because
mm-hmm.
naming is an analytic task.
Right.
That is, it's the idea that the things that we see don't actually have names apart from the names we give them.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent to which we want to name things interferes with our ability to see them psychically.
Yeah, it's a limiting construct that you're putting on them.
So that psychic functioning is really a non-analytic ability.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in remote viewing, we usually have two people working on a task. We'd have one person who's an analyst, like myself,
mm-hmm.
working with the psychic of the day, and I encourage the psychic to describe his or her mental impressions. Don't name the thing. What is the shape or form or color? What describe what you see, but don't name that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And make a drawing of it, but don't make it into something. Just draw the shape and the form that comes to view. And the extent to which I can help a person describe their experience without naming it is the extent to which they can be successful. And that was all understood 1,200 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's almost like the minute the left brain comes in and defines something, then the flow of information coming in through the right brain is cut off.
That's right. That if I'm asking a person to describe someplace, and he
mm-hmm.
says, I see some bricks, there's a curved building, and I'm happy to hear that. And then he says, I think it's Macy's.
Mm-hmm.
That would end the experiment.
That ends it. Right.
I would say, well, don't tell me about Macy's. Let's start over.
Right.
And tell me what you're experiencing.
Right.
Because in my experience, the psychic is usually the last one to correctly assess what he's actually describing.
Because
mm-hmm. the psychic is in a altered state.
Right.
There's no drugs, no flashing lights or hypnosis,
right.
But you have to it's required that you surrender your analytical ability and just allow your awareness to fill space-time and go to the target of the day.
Right.
Or go to the person of the day and describe
mm-hmm.
your experience. But as soon as you try and name it, you stop that process.
That's right. Well, we're coming up at the end of our hour, Russell. We've been interviewing Russell Targ, who is the author of Memoirs of a Blind Biker, Do You See What I See?, Lasers and Love, ESP and the CIA, and The Meaning of Life. Would you like to give your contact information and the information about the Omega Conference one more time?
Yeah, I'm very happy for people to communicate with me. My website is www.espresearch.com, and that shows what workshops that are coming up and also lets you communicate with me. And my Omega workshop is the end of August at Rhinebeck, New York, at beautiful Omega facility. And at the weekend workshop, I'm happy to see you there.
And I'd encourage everybody to read not only this book, but Russell's other books. They're fabulous, Limitless Mind, and his other books are fabulous.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Russell. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been interviewing Dr. Targ on his latest book, Next week, we have, we have Steps to Enlightenment, more very interesting spiritual information from a healer in Hawaii. And then on the 30th, Gabriel Weiss, Dr. Weiss's book is The Healing Power of Meditation. We have every third Thursday, Noetic Science at the Dunwoody Center, 4370 Georgetown Square. Mickey Buckland is going to be giving his lecture on Thursday, May 21st, that's this week, The Life of an Intuitive, Growing Up Clairvoyant. We interviewed Mickey last week, and it's interesting to interview the clairvoyants. They stay in these altered states that Russell Targ was talking about and kind of live there, and I think that's something worth learning about directly from the source. If you have any information or questions about our group practice, Plastica Surgery Center and Millennium Healthcare, please see our website, www.templeofhealth.ws, or contact us at 770-457-4677. We have a very extensive group practice with many holistic therapies, and information in the community health source is on the website, the monthly newsletter. Again, thank you for joining us, and we will be with you next week.
Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong, it was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677.